I thought I could move past this, but I can't. I can't fling myself into the arms of another person that's just going to use me. And I'm not going to bring a baby into this kind of relationship. Fuck you and fuck your cootie. Do not leave, I growl as I hear the door open. I press a hand to my cock, but the front of my breeches is still wet with spend. If I turn around, she will see my shame, and I cannot bear to see the scorn in her eyes, like the scorn Zala always had for me. But the door closes again a moment later, and the room is silent. She has gone anyhow, and I am left with wet breeches and stinging pride.
Josie. I can't do it. I thought I could, but I can't. He didn't even kiss me. A kiss shouldn't have mattered so much, but it feels like everything. It feels as if Hayden didn't want me there. Like I was just a body for him to jerk off on. I've been that body before, and it sucks. All I wanted was a kiss. To feel cherished for once. I sigh and wipe the frustrated tears from my eyes. I can't cry over this. I've already had my one night of tears. No more. I retie the laces of my tunic at my neck and head for the main computer room. For some reason, I keep expecting Hayden to come after me, to come coax me back into his arms, to shower me with kisses and show me that I was wrong, that he didn't mean to make me feel bad, but no one comes. And I can't believe I'm disappointed over that. I feel like such an idiot. I've made things worse. Not only do I still have unfinished resonance, but now I've fought with Hayden. Again. I just wish there was a way out of this. Somehow. I plop down in one of the uncomfortable, slick chairs that have managed to last the hundreds of years from the crash. The one I'm sitting in is oversized, perfect for someone as big as Hayden, but not so great for someone my size. My feet dangle and I kick them, then lean forward and pick up an errant object on the counter. Hey, computer, where's Harlow? My readouts show that Harlow is in her private quarters with her companion and her child. Do you wish to locate them? I can provide directions. No, thanks. I toss the chip aside and pick through the items on the countertop, miserable. What about Hayden? The modified sock mail that you arrived with is still in room 3A. Still there? He's probably expecting me to come back. He can just keep waiting. I find a rounded circle of what looks like glass and take it in hand. It's smooth to the touch and about the size of my palm. Computer, what's this for? The computer rattles off an explanation that I don't grasp in the slightest. I make a few noises of acknowledgement just to be polite and sit back in the chair, swinging my legs like a little kid and playing with my new toy. The glass is slightly thicker in the center, and I lift it to my eye and peer because it reminds me of a kaleidoscope. When I bring it to my eye, though, everything rushes forward. Ooh, a magnifier of sorts. I bet you could make a kick-ass Not-Hoth telescope with this. Of course, it'd be useless on me because I never get to travel anywhere. Everyone thinks I'm too fragile. I flip it in my fingers again, and an idea hits me. What if I leave? Just leave and not come back. Will my Kui give up if I'm separated from Hayden by 100 miles? I keep flipping the circle of glass in my fingers. I'm not hating this idea. It'll mean leaving everyone behind, but I already feel left out. They've all happily mated and are expecting me to just roll over and let Hayden run roughshod over me and give me a baby. For the last month, I've been the recipient of tons of sympathy glances or looks of pity. I hate both. I remember Tiffany telling me a few weeks ago that she wanted to leave. Just start walking and never come back. But now I get it. I don't want to wait around for everyone to expect me to leap into Hayden's furs. I don't want them all watching my every move to see when I give in. I don't want the smug looks of pity when they find out that silly Josie's still holding out. I can just leave. After all, what's tying me here? Friends? They've all been mated and are building families. They're happy and in love. Even Tiffany, who wanted to leave a short time ago. I thought she was crazy. But back then, I hadn't walked from the Elder's Cave to the Tribal Cave on my own with nothing but a crude homemade compass. I can do it. I think of the little cave Harlow lived in with Rook, the one by the ocean. I've always wanted to see the ocean.
Chapter 8. Hayden. I cannot figure out how Josie made the wall open. I slap at it over and over again, trying to find the way out. I want to go to my mate, to drag her back into the room, wet pants or not, and find out why she has changed her mind. Her words echo in my head. I can't fling myself into the arms of another person that's just going to use me. I want to find out what she means by that. Who has used her? I will rip their heads from their bodies and stomp on their innards. More than anything, I want more of her soft touches, the little sounds she makes when I touch her. I play them over and over in my mind until my cock is hard once more, and there is no way to ease the ache. There is also no way out of the room. I pound against the wall over and over again, but as time passes, it becomes more and more obvious to me that she is not coming back. So, seething, I wait. I lie down on the hard stone-like shelf, stretch out my legs, and wait for Josie to come back. My mind wanders to thoughts of her returning, begging my forgiveness. She's decided she wants my touch after all. She crawls over me, all silky brown hair and eager mouth. And when I touch her, she makes more of those soft whimpery noises that send a pulse of need right through me. I wake up some time later, quee humming, my cock still hard and my breechcloth wet again from my dream. And still no Josie. Cursing, I rip one of the decorative panels from my leathers and scrub at my wet belly and groin. Twice now I have come in my pants. I snarl as I toss the wet leather aside and then push at the wall again, trying to get it to move. When it doesn't budge, I slam my shoulder into it over and over again. This room will not keep me from my mate. Nothing will. Hayden? I hear a confused voice in the distance from the far side of the wall. It is Harlow. Is that you? Let me out, I bellow. The wall will not open. As if determined to prove me wrong, the wall opens easily a moment later. Several paces down from where I am slamming my body against it. Harlow gives me a confused look, hefting her kit onto her shoulder. Her mate is 2 paces behind her. What's going on? I didn't realize you were still here. Still here? Of course I am here. I slap a hand at the frustrating wall and shove past. Where is Josie? See, that's the thing, Harlow calls after me. I thought she was with you. Her words make no sense. I storm into the main area of the Elder's cave. The fire pit is nothing but coals. Her pack, originally next to mine by the cave entrance, is gone. Her snowshoes and her heavy outer furs are nowhere. My Kui is silent. I rub my breast, determined not to panic. She has moved to another one of the rooms, then. She has retreated from the main cave because she needs space from me. She would not just leave, not with Resonance still singing an unfulfilled song between us. I head back into the winding caves toward Harlow. Where is Josie? I think she left. Her eyes are wide, upset. Did you guys have an argument? I snarl at the thought and race back to the front of the cave. I take a few steps outside, and there, in the falling snow, is the slushy, dragging trail that snowshoes leave behind. I bend down to touch one track. It is heading away from the Elder's cave, but she is not heading to the South Cave, nor to the Travel Cave. Instead, she is veering in a completely different direction. Where is Josie going? Alone? Is it because of me? I rub my breast again, hating the guilt that swoops through me. Was I that cruel? I am not the most patient of males, but I would never harm her. Yet she has left, and left without saying a word to me or to Harlow. She has crept away. I imagine her sad face, the tears falling from her eyes, the cold biting at her small human form. I grit my teeth and return to the Elder's cave, determined. Harlow is there, holding her kit to her shoulder, worried. Is it true? Is she gone? I will go after her, I tell Harlow. She will be safe under my watch. She bites her lip and looks at her mate. He puts a hand on her shoulder to comfort her. Take food, Ruch instructs in his broken language, for you and Josie. I grunt in acknowledgement of his wise words. I can hunt for myself and will never starve, but it is always wise to have dried food on hand for the days when the weather is too bad to leave shelter. I heft my pack, and it's lighter than normal. Frowning, I open it to realize that my neat, orderly things are out of place. My rations are gone, along with my extra water skin. A reluctant smile of admiration curves my mouth. My mate has raided my pack and taken supplies. Instead of infuriating me, it makes me feel good. She is clever and smart, mind you, see. She will not run off into the wild unprepared. I look over at Rook. I will need an extra spear and knife and some rations for myself. Rook nods.
You'll bring her back? Harlow asks.
If that is her wish, I want to see where she is going first and why she left without me. Harlow nods and looks up at Rook, still worried. He presses his mouth to her forehead. A kiss, the humans call it. A kiss? I did not kiss Josie. I did not hold her in the tender, easy way that Rook holds his mate. And I am ashamed. There are many things that I have done wrong this day. I will right them or die trying. I set out a short time later, easily picking up Josie's trail. There is a light, powdery snow on the air, but not enough to cover her tracks. She has made no attempt to hide her trail, and for a time I entertained the thought that she wishes to be found. That she will see me tracking her and rush into my arms and shower my face with the little presses of her mouth that humans call kisses. But as her trail stretches on and the weather grows steadily worse, I realize this is a fantasy. She has no intention of returning. My chest aches with the realization that my mate has abandoned me. I have not pleased her. I did not caress her properly, and when she touched me, I spent my seed in my loincloth like an untried kit. I thought to hide my shame from her, but it seems that she has been hurt by my actions. When I find her, I will explain myself and seek her forgiveness. I will ask her how she wishes to be pleasured. This time I will do it right. Even though I make good time, I am many hours behind her. The twin suns set behind the distant mountains and the air grows cold. I pull on a fur wrap to block the worst of the wind, but I think of Josie and her fragile human body. She will be shivering with cold, unable to last a night out in the open. I must find her and build her a fire. I must shelter her with my own body so she does not freeze. No sooner do I think it than a tiny light appears on the horizon. It flickers and then flares brighter, yellow in the dark night. I catch the faint scent of smoke. A fire. Pride bursts in my chest. My Josie is not so helpless after all. I approach, quieting my footsteps. I see the outline of the tiny cave. One of the hunter caves, scattered like wind-blown seeds across the landscape, and she is at the mouth of one, feeding bits of fuel to her fire. I devour the sight of her small form. She looks healthy, wrapped in her furs, and when she stands, she seems tired but not shivering with cold. After a moment, she pulls the privacy screen over the cave entrance, blotting out some of the light given off by the fire. I am left out in the snow, pondering. With a fire, she is safe. Even the most aggressive of Metlaks will not approach a flame, and this particular region has very few large predators. I am impressed that she was able to find one of the hunter caves, build a fire, and take care of herself. My fragile Josie is stronger than I have imagined, and instead of storming into her cave and demanding that she return, I hunch in the snow and settle in for the night. I will put up a watch to ensure she is undisturbed. But if my Josie wants to go somewhere, I will follow until it is no longer safe for her, and then I will step in.
Josie. So far, I've got the hang of this survival on my own thing. Yesterday I hiked until I found a cave, made myself a fire, thanks to the fire starter necklaces that one of the girls insisted we all have, and spent the evening cozy and warm. And okay, it was a little terrifying to be out on my own. A lot, actually. Despite being tired from a day of walking, I'd had a heck of a time falling asleep. The knowledge that I was the only one around for miles and no one knew where I was? It did a bit of a head trip on me, and I clutched at my furs, terrified. Every noise made me jerk awake. Add in the fact that I'm feeling restless and out of sorts thanks to resonance? It wasn't a fun night. At some point I went to sleep, and when I woke up, my fire was dead, there was frost on my furs, and my breath was puffing in the air like a cloud once more. I was also aching from resonance, my nipples hard and my pussy wet. Time to get up. I stretched and shook out my furs, doing a little jog to try and make my body focus on the day instead of sex. The furs were a little damp from yesterday's travel, so I rebuilt my fire and spread them out to dry before heading on. If I started walking around lunchtime, it wouldn't be so bad. I feed more dried dung to my fire and wash my hands with a bit of snow, then take out a pack of rations. I help myself to a handful of the granola-like stuff, wrinkling my nose as I eat. The cootie has dampened a lot of my senses. Smells are not as keen, and neither are tastes. But this particular saquie dish is still spicier than I like. I wash it down with the last of my water and realize I have no more. Time to melt some snow. It's a little intimidating to realize that I can't depend on anyone else to help me. If I need water, I have to get it myself. Fire? I need to pick up supplies as I walk. I put the last few bites of my trail rations back into my pouch. Who knows how long it'll have to last me? I've never hunted before, and the enormity of the task looms before me. Well, I'll just have to figure it out somehow, because I'm not going back. When my furs are dry enough and snow melted from my water skins, I put out my fire and dress in my heavy furs again, then put on my snowshoes. I leave the cave and start heading toward the west. Harlow and Rue had come from the west, and that's where the ocean was, so that is where I'm heading. She had said the temperatures were milder there. I tug one of my gloves higher and figure mild is just darn fine with me. The snow is thicker this morning, which means more must have fallen overnight. I trudge through the powder with my backpack over my shoulder. After an hour, I'm already exhausted and sweaty, but I keep going. This is what I want, so I'm going to have to suck it up. I need to enjoy the scenery. This is my chance to really see more of Not Hoth than just the caves. And Not Hoth? For all that it's cold and blustery, it's also really beautiful. Hill after endless hill of white snow undulates before me. The landscape is dotted with the occasional feathery pink tree and more of the shorter, frothier bushes thick with piney leaves. In the distance, there's a herd of Dvisti, their shaggy, grayish-white coats making them look a lot like overgrown sheep with spindly legs. I suppose I should think of them as food, but right now I'm enjoying the scenery. The sky is overcast as usual, but that just means there's no glare on the snow. In the distance, the purplish, spiky peaks of ice dance across the skyline, and I wonder if I'm going to have to cross them to get to the ocean. Gosh, I hope not. I'm not a mountain climber. I head into a valley, following the easiest path to walk, and then over the next hill. Something shakes the ground, and I freeze, looking around. There in the distance is a Sakotsk and its baby. It lumbers over the snow with slow, almost lazy motions of its long, skinny legs, and I find myself drawn toward it despite the danger it presents. It's hideous. The hide is shaggy like the Dvisti, but the legs are a tough, sinewy hide that leads down to flat, wide hooves. The head itself is the size of a car and dotted with glowing blue eyes like a spider. Gross. As I watch, it moves its big head back and forth as if tasting the air. I wonder what something so big eats. Hopefully, not people. I follow it for a time, fascinated. I've never gone to the zoo, and this is a lot like a big, icy, open zoo. I wonder if I could get close enough to touch one. The baby Sakotsk is bigger than I am, but still seems more approachable. I'm tempted to chase after it. Until the mama Sakotsk lets loose an epic stream of piss. Squealing, I trundle away from their trail as fast as I can in my snowshoes. Gross, gross, gross. After that, I decide following animals is probably not the smartest thing. I also realize I don't have a spear. I do have a small knife that I keep with me at all times, but it's not exactly built for hunting, and I don't really want to have to kill something with a blade the size of a pocket knife. How the heck did I forget to bring a spear? I'm kicking myself for that, and in addition to scanning the ground for dung chips for the evening's fire, I look for something that will make a decent spear. There's nothing, of course. In the icy, windy landscape, the trees are whippy and frail, and the bushes aren't big enough to provide much wood. This is why all the weapons back at the cave are bone, I remind myself. Of course, you have to be able to bring down a kill, a really honking big one, to find a bone big enough to make a spear out of. Maybe there will be spears at Harlow and Rook's old cave. I'll just have to make my rations last that long, and I'll be set. Encouraged, I pick up the pace a little and head over the next rise. It'll all work itself out, and for the first time in what feels like forever, my cootie is silent in my chest. I may be exhausted from traveling, I may be needy and sick with thwarted sexual desire, but my chest is all quiet. I'll take the small victories.
Chapter 9 Hayden.
Josie is much stronger than I have given her credit for. She is tired, but she walks a good distance every day, even when her snowshoes drag on the ground. She has been lucky in finding shelter. The first two nights she found hunter caves, and the third she made herself a nest in the rocky shelter of a ledge out of the wind at the base of a cliff. She is smart. She is resourceful, too. I watch from a distance as she picks up dung as she walks, or scoops up snow and pulls her pouch under her furs to melt it. She does not, however, look behind her. This does not surprise me. Josie is the type to plunge forward in life. I am the sour one that looks behind. But if she looked but once, she would see me on the horizon, trailing behind her, watching to make sure she does not wander into a nest of Metlaks, or that she is not hunted by a hungry snowcat. But no, Josie is smart and she is cautious, and I am proud of how well she is doing, even if she does not seem to want to go back. She continues to head toward the mountains every day, always in the same direction. It is intriguing to me. Where is she going? What does she think she will find? She treads over hunting trails and goes over hills and crosses over rocky outcroppings that make my body tense with the need to rescue her. But she is not being foolhardy. She is cautious. She pauses at every stream and checks for Neluch, the fish that humans call face-eaters, and sprinkles crushed berries upstream to get them to leave before she crosses. If she sees tracks of other animals, she changes her route. I rub my chest as I watch her peek her head into another hunter cave. Last night she slept in the open, and while she kept her fire going, it took everything I had not to step in and lead her toward shelter. I know these lands like I know my own tail, and I do not want to see her suffer. But this is important to her, so I will follow her for however long it is necessary, or until my qui becomes unbearable. Even now, just thinking about her causes my cock to rise. When I know she is safe for the evening, I will rub myself until I come, but it does no more than whet the itch. Just once I wish she would look back. I wish she would see me waiting on the horizon for her, waiting to take care of her, to comfort her, to be her man and her mate, and whatever else she needs. But she never turns. I hope wherever Josie is going, she gets there soon.
Josie, the ocean is beautiful. After days of walking, my supplies are getting low, my feet feel battered, and I'm utterly exhausted. But when I hike up a rocky ridge and see the distant, rolling, jade-green waves of the water, it's something else. The outcropping I'm on ends abruptly, and far below I see gritty sand, a darker shade of green than the water itself, and frosty, light-green icebergs floating in the distant water. This is so cool. I remove my snowshoes and take a seat on the ledge so I can relax and gaze out at the ocean. From my vantage point, I can see for miles. It's really something. The waves are tranquil and the water looks so soothing. I pull out my trail mix pouch and eat a few crumbs as I enjoy the view. I don't have much left, but I'm at my destination. Well, sort of. I don't see anything that looks like the caves Harlow described, so maybe I'm in the wrong spot. I lick the last few crumbs from my fingers and ignore the grumbling of my stomach. It'll have to last. On a whim, I dig out the disc of glass from my bag. I'm a little ashamed to say I stole it from Harlow, but if the surgery machine is broken, does it even matter? Nothing else is half as useful, and I plan on using the heck out of this thing. I cut my fingers around the edges and hold it to my eye like I would a telescope. At first, it makes my gaze blurry. So I try focusing with one eye closed, and things zoom into place. Now I can see much further away. Excited, I use it to gaze down at the ocean. The water doesn't look as green or as soothing a little closer. In fact, the waves look downright nasty, and I can see dark blobs scuttling on the shore. A shadow flies overhead, and I put my telescope down, glancing up. There's a gigantic bird overhead, rushing past at a speed I've never seen before. Holy crap, it's fast. I lift my spyglass again, but it moves so quick I can't catch a view of it. Darn. I turn back to the ocean and peer out at the icebergs. There's dark shapes on them that I can't make out. Maybe the Nothoth version of seals? Ice otters? Something? A moment later, the waves undulate, and a thin, yellowish snake-like thing erupts from the waves and snatches one of the dark shapes off of the iceberg and disappears under the water with it. I shudder. Mental note? No swimming. I move the telescope over the water, scanning. Mostly there's nothing to see but more waves, but as I sweep over the distant horizon, a faint smear of lighter green against the water catches my eye. I try to focus in, but no matter how much I squint, I can't see what it is. At first, I think it's another sea serpent, but when it doesn't move, I realize it's something else. Land, maybe? But it's green. Maybe I should check it out. I turn my telescope back to the icebergs and see another dark shape flutter under the water. Maybe I won't check out the green if it means going through Jurassic Park Aqua Edition. Hayden would know what those things are. For a moment, I feel an unhappy pang of longing that has nothing to do with my cootie. I put down my spyglass and rub my forehead, where a headache is starting. It's weird, but I miss Hayden. With all this travel, my cootie's gone mostly silent, though I dream of Hayden at night, and when I wake up, my chest is vibrating with resonance. That isn't what makes me miss him, though. I miss his presence, knowing that he's there for me. It's strange, but no one's ever really been there for me in my life. When the shit hit the fan, everyone else ran away. Not Hayden. He might glare and put up a fuss, but he's always been there. Funny how I didn't realize it until I left. He's still insufferable and a prick, but he's growing on me. Or was. I imagine what he'd say if he knew I went all the way out to the ocean on my own. He'd scowl, his tail flicking, and cross his big arms. You're weak, Josie. Females must be protected. Humans cannot travel like the Saqui. I'm gleeful, imagining the smug look on his face changing to one of wonder as he realizes just what I've done. That I'm a tough cookie. And some of my enjoyment fades when I realize he'll never realize what I've accomplished, because I'll never see him again. I hate the wistful ache in my breast. I've made my choice, and I won't cry over it. Another bird flies overhead, and I squint at it. Eagles? This area reminds me of a much, much colder Pacific Northwest, and there are eagles in that area. Probably not too safe to be up on the ridge, then. I'll leave just as soon as I figure out where Harlow's cave is. I raise the glass again, and this time I scan the rocks. The cliff below shows nothing interesting, and I sweep up, up, up into the distance until I realize I'm staring at the base of the Purple Mountains, the ones that look like glass or rock candy. Pretty, but not what I want. Still, I can't help but study them for a bit because I've seen nothing like them before. That's when I notice the wreckage. My spyglass sweeps over one mountain, and in the snow at the base, there's a dark shape half covered in snow. There are hard edges to it and a blinking red light, and the pit of my stomach curdles, sick. It's a ship. It can't be. Can it? Chapter 10. Josie. When I decided to set off and become Ice Explorer Josie, I'd expected one of two things. Sucking miserably at it and returning home, or finding Harlow's cave and hiding out there until my cootie gave up. I didn't expect to find another spaceship. I stare at the square. It's not our ship. It's not the one we came from. That one was near the peak of a granite-like mountain, and this one is surrounded by purple rock candy peaks. Ours had a breach in the hull at the top, and the rest of the compartment we'd landed in was relatively secure. It was the only way we'd managed to survive the elements for a week despite no cold weather, gear, and no supplies. The snow had insulated us, and our body heat kept us warm. This wreckage is different. Even though it's a square, it looks like one end is mangled, like a cereal box torn open at the bottom. There's snow, but I see a blinking red light. Maybe it's a distress beacon of some kind. Oh, crap. What if there's someone that needs a rescue and all they've got is me? I put down my spyglass, thinking. Okay, panicking. A little panic's totally justified, though. I don't know what I'm going to do. We haven't seen any ships fly overhead in the year and a half that we've been on Knot Hoth. No one's tried to re-kidnap us. It's a trap, Admiral Akbar's voice says in my ears. Yeah, it feels a bit like a trap. Of course, the more I think logically about it, the more I wonder. A ship returned a few months after we'd arrived. They stole Kira again, shot Ihako and Hayden. Oh, crap, Hayden. And left them for dead. Kira had saved the day when she crashed the ship and took an escape pod back to Ihako's side. It's a story that's been told around the campfire over and over again. I've heard it a dozen times, mostly because I gleefully enjoyed the part where Hayden got his guts shot up. Man, I've been a jerk to the guy. I feel a twinge of guilt and then shove it away. Focus, Joe. Okay. Okay. I close my eyes, picturing Kira telling the story in her solemn voice. She'd set the spaceship on autopilot and pointed it at the distant mountains where it had crashed. Both Ihako and Kira had seen the crash. Distant mountains. These mountains. I exhale a breath of relief. That has to be it. This is the ship Kira crashed, and when she'd crashed it, there were no survivors. They were all already dead. It was a little, well, bloodthirsty. But it's hard to feel sorry for someone that stole you from Earth and wanted to re-enslave you. I'm not sorry they're dead. But I still don't know what to do. Do I check out the wreckage and hope there's something useful? Or do I go hunt down Harlow's cave with its supplies? Or do I somehow make a boat and check out the green smear in the distant waves that might be an island? This feels like an Ice Age version of House Hunters. Does Josie want adventure in an island cabana despite the dangerous location? Or will she choose a beachfront property, provided she can ever find Harlow's cave? Or will she choose the house in the mountains, even though it might already be occupied? I look around me. The cliff has greenery, but it's scrubby and twisted, designed to cling to the rock through the snow and the high wind. There's nothing around here that would make a canoe, even if I knew how to make one, or a raft. And the thought of getting into that sea monster-infested water scares me. Island, you're going to have to wait for another day, I tell it. House one eliminated. Now, in true House Hunter's fashion, I need to narrow it down to two choices. I ponder this, even as another dark shape moves through the sky, the shadow rippling over me. Whatever I decide, it's not smart to stay here. I give another quick glance through the spyglass at the cliffs below, but I don't see a cave. Shit. I turn my glass back to the wreckage, in the opposite direction. The red light winks at me. If that's the wreckage I'm thinking of, there's no survivors. But what if I'm wrong? But what if they have food? And guns? And things I can use to survive? Right now, I've got a pocket knife and maybe a handful of trail mix left. I chew on my lip, thinking, and toy with the spyglass, flipping it through my fingers. It's been surprisingly handy, and it wasn't even meant for this. Who knows what kinds of goodies the other alien ship will have? I put the spyglass in my pack, I sling it over my shoulder, put my snowshoes back on, and head down the cliffs toward the wreckage. If I'm here, I might as well see what I can salvage. The wreckage is a bit further away than it appeared in my stupid spyglass. Okay, a lot further away. I hike for the rest of the day and don't make it there before the sun starts to set. There's not much shelter around, so I find a few scrubby bushes to act as a windbreak and spend the last hour before sunset pushing the snow higher into the bushes so they form a wall. I have a bit of a dugout, and I build my fire there, spending the entire night shivering and feeding more fuel to it so I don't freeze. By the time morning comes, I'm exhausted. I let the fire die and take a quick nap in the sunlight until the bleating of a nearby Divisti herd wakes me up. I head off toward the crashed ship again, and when the suns are high in the sky, I arrive at the ship.
Hayden. It takes everything I have not to go to Josie's side during the night and offer to assist. She would not appreciate it, and when I see her creating the windbreak with the snow, I know she is smart. She will be fine, if not comfortable. Still, I stay closer than I normally do, my spirit the ready, and watch over her. She is in the open, and if anything tries to approach her, I will gut it for daring to get near my mate. After her morning nap, she takes off again, and I follow behind her, far enough so she will not notice me. As I do, I notice that her path crosses other tracks in the snow. I slow, letting her get ahead so I can study them. I crouch low and touch one. The snow has not crusted, which means it is fresh. And the clawed toes? Metlak. Many of them. Josie's in danger.
Josie. The flashing light I'd seen in my spyglass is a lot brighter the closer I get. It's an exterior light of some kind and blindingly bright, making me see spots every time it goes off. I shrug off a fur wrap and throw it over the light, only to hear my fur sizzling and the smell of burning leather. I quickly yank it off again. The light's so hot the snow melts when it touches it. Well, that's not a good sign. I circle around the wreckage to give it a once-over. There's snow piled up around it, and so I can't make out the shape, but the boxy end that's torn open and sticking out of the snow? Yeah, that looks familiar. The mountains that looked like purple glass from a distance are clearly ice, and I'm amazed at the massiveness of them. This ice must be hundreds or thousands of years old to have formed mountains, and at the base I see a tinge of green. Okay, then. How did the ocean become green if these mountains are purple? I wish I knew. Maybe it's algae or something. I'm not a scientist, so I can only guess. But the snow that falls is white, as are the drifts covering the craft, which tells me that this is definitely a recent addition to the landscape. I circle around it one more time, trying to determine how big it is. It's not like the ancestor ship, which is a long, rounded oval as big as a shopping mall. This one's more like a wedge, I think, and as long as the city block. Most of it is buried in the snow except for the cargo end. If there was debris, or bodies, they were covered by the snow a long time ago. I'm kind of glad for that. I don't want to see a bunch of corpses sticking out of the snow. I shudder at the thought. I approach the busted end of the spaceship that sticks out of the drifts. It's tilted to the side, and one end sticks out high from the snow, but the other end is climbable with a little effort, I think. Hello? I call out. Anyone home? No answer. Not surprising, given the remoteness of the location or the fact that the ship's crashed. If this was Kira's ship, everyone was dead before the thing ever landed. I swallow hard at the thought, squeamish. I've seen TV shows with car accidents. I hope I'm not going to see corpse splatters all over the inside of the ship. Or worse, corpse splatter popsicles. I press a mitten to my mouth and hurk a little. But I've come this far. I need to keep going. After the overheated flashing light, I worry that parts of the ship will be too hot to touch. I throw my fur wrap over the part I've designated as my point of entrance, and when it doesn't sizzle, I climb into the dark hollow pit. Hello? No answer. No light, either. Crap. I retreat back out and attack one of the scrubby bushes nearby, taking twiggy limbs and ripping them off, then twisting them into a bundle. I hold my bundle against the flicking emergency light until it smokes and then lights up. It's a crappy torch, and drips embers everywhere, but it'll do. I don't plan on staying down there long. It gives me the creeps. I crawl back into the busted hall carefully, torch in hand, and start to explore. I thought this was the cargo area, but apparently not. It's a different part of the ship, and it looks like the entire thing is turned sideways. I'm in a narrow hall and standing on what was probably a space window or something. There's furniture and other small objects peppered on the floor, mixed in with debris, and I kick through it looking for guns. The aliens that kidnapped us originally had guns that looked a lot like clubs the size of a rifle, and I could use one of those. There's a door half open ahead of me, and I hold my torch aloft, peering in. Bodies. Lots of bodies, frozen in their seats. I stagger backward and retch, then get angry at myself for doing so. Of course there are bodies. Quit being so girly, Josie. I picture Hayden chastising me, but instead of filling me with irritation, I'm filled with wistful sadness. I wish he was here. He'd hold the torch and put an arm around me, and it wouldn't matter that I'm a little girly and scared because he'd be by my side. And he only needles me because he's scared of how fragile I am. The realization strikes me like a brick. That's why he's so protective. That's why he's such a dick when I try to be independent and is constantly talking about how women should be protected. He's scared someone's going to die and then the remaining mate will have to suffer like he has. Maybe I've been too mean to him. I pick a different passageway and head through it, determined to be strong. It's a dead end, though, blocked by debris and slag and hanging cables. I can't go further, so I turn around and look for the next passage. A short time later, my torch is burning down to cinders in my hand, and I haven't found anything useful. Well, scratch that. I found a room that was private quarters, and the only things not rotted away were a small blanket made of a weird, plastic-feeling material and a cushion-like pillow made out of the same. I stuff them both into my bag, even though I don't know what I'm going to do with them. I decide to check one last hallway before heading out, because I'm determined to find something I can use. But the moment I step through the next doorway, I'm hit by old memories. This is the cargo bay. Or was. There's a hole in the ceiling that is letting light in, and there's a light dusting of snow in the middle of the floor. The cargo bay's contents are scattered everywhere, crates smashed and their contents destroyed. I swallow hard at the sight of this place. If I close my eyes, I can hear the crying, smell the unwashed bodies, see the faces of the guards as they leered at us, and more. I bite the inside of my cheek until I no longer feel like screaming or weeping. I've already cried over that, and I won't give it more time in my head. I shake the bad memories away and focus on the good things. If this is the cargo bay, maybe there's food. Maybe there's supplies. When I turn to the left, though, I see them. Tubes. Oh, God. I head toward the wall, trembling. There's a thin coat of ice on it, and half of it is collapsed. I can barely make out 3 tubes. I brush a hand over the snow and ice and immediately amend my count. 2 tubes. There's nothing but scorched remains of the third, the wall crumpled away. I hope you didn't have an occupant. When I smooth away the ice and snow over the next one, though, the green light flashes. I remember that light. It means there's someone inside. Shit, fuck, damn! Saying the words aloud doesn't make it any better, but it feels necessary. I run a hand over the next pod's panel. Yellow lights flicking to green. I don't know what that means, but I'm betting it also has an occupant. Fuck! Fuck, fuck, fuck! This I'm going to cry over. I allow myself to burst into tears and sob. Because now, I have to go back. Chapter 11. Josie. When I emerge from the ship, I don't expect to see another person in the distance. But up on a distant hill, I see blue skin and horns and the graceful movements of a male Sakwi locked in combat. It's obviously Hayden. I recognize his motions even as my Kui starts a low hum in my chest. My anger and frustration at being followed disappears when I realize why he's turning on one leg and flinging a spear. He's fighting something that looks, well, a bit like a skinny gray yeti. A Metlak, my brain tells me, though I've never seen one. I've heard the stories. They're tall, monkey-like creatures that are almost as intelligent as they are vicious. Liz has told me hair-raising tales of running across them in the wild, and I'm alarmed to see one here. As another pounces on Hayden's back, only to be brushed off, I realize that there's not just one or two, but a dozen of the creatures. Oh, shit. Were they following me? Is this my fault? Guilt and alarm surge through me, and I rush forward to offer my assistance as another pounces on him, only to realize that I have nothing but a tiny knife. Fuck. What do I do? I look over at the flashing emergency light and am nearly blinded by it as it blinks again. I need something else to burn. They're afraid of fire. But the only thing I have is my bag. I hesitate a moment and then dump my food and water pouch out on the ground and gather up a few handfuls of the debris at the edge of the ship, then stuff one of my furs into the bag. In goes my new pillow. In goes the small blanket of the strange, shiny material. Then I rush forward and hold my bag against the light, squeezing my eyes shut against the flare of red light as the leather sizzles angrily. There's no time to gather more wood for a torch, and I pray that the leather will catch on fire. The bag hisses angrily, and smoke starts to pour forth. Come on, I whisper, glancing up at the hill where Hayden was fighting just a moment ago. He's still there, flinging another metlac aside, and my heart hammers with a mix of relief and worry. Come on, I tell my bag again. Hurry! The damn thing doesn't want to catch, though. I give a low growl of frustration and then toss my bag down. The shiny blanket catches my eye, and I grab it and hold it against the light, hoping that it's not flame retardant or I'm really screwed. If this doesn't work, I'll have to go help Hayden with my bare hands. Leaving him is not an option. The blanket begins to hiss as I hold my hands against the superheated light, and my fingertips blister as I hold it there. I squeal and jerk my hands away, but the blanket is smoking. It's working. Before I can think about it too much, I shove the blanket against the light again and hold it there, trying to ignore the pain in my hands. Hot tears pour from my eyes, and I moan as my fingers continue to blister. Just when I can take it no more, the blanket catches. Yellow flames lick at the edges, and then the entire thing starts to crawl with fire. I pull it away and dash toward Hayden with my flaming bundle, yelling at the top of my lungs. I don't know who's more surprised to see me running at them, full throttle with a flaming blanket, Hayden or the Metlacs. The big blue male pauses only for a brief second, and then he slams his spear into the side of the creature he's fighting. The others back off even as Hayden roars, a primal sound. I shake my burning blanket at them as they cringe backward, and one by one they peel off and run away, dashing for the hills. Just in time, too. My blanket's crawling flame has only been aggravated by my running and the wind, and it's licking at my hands. With a yelp, I toss the blanket to the ground and then blow on my stinging, burning hands.
Josie?
Hayden's voice makes me turn. His big shoulders are heaving as he pants, and his vest is torn. There are scratches and gouges on his arms, and one on his face from the Metlac claws, but he looks fine otherwise. I face him, ignoring my throbbing hands for a moment, and wait for the lecture. Knowing him, it'll start with females are weak, and end with something about me playing with fire. Oblivious to the emotions spitting between us, my Kui hums a happy song in time with his. He says nothing. Is he waiting for me to admit I'm sorry? Not gonna happen. I wave a hand at him, beckoning. Go ahead and give it to me. Hayden puts an arm around my shoulders, and in the next moment, I'm pulled to his chest, my cheek squished against a broad pectoral as he hugs me to him. I freeze because it's the last thing I'm expecting. His arms wrap around me, and then he's holding me with both big, strong arms as if I'm the best thing he's ever seen. I realize I'm not going to get a lecture. Well, not yet, because he's relieved. He's so happy to see me that he's hugging me. And, okay, it feels really good to be hugged. His hand strokes over my hair as he holds me to his chest, and I close my eyes and bask in the warmth of his body against mine, and how wonderful it feels just to have someone touch me with simple happiness. I've never been hugged much. And I can see right away why some people are addicted to cuddling. Hayden's strong body holding me close is bliss. In his arms, I feel safe and protected, and the worries of the world slip away. But then, one of my hands brushes against his clothing, and a shot of pain rips through me. I hiss and back away, gazing at them. My fingers and my palms are purple and starting to blister. Hayden grabs one of my hands, taking care not to touch the injured spots.
Josie, what have you done?
Yes. That's the Hayden I remember. It's called saving your ass.
You have saved more of me than my ass,
he says, and I swallow the smart-ass comment bubbling in my head. He glances around and then retrieves his spear. With his other arm, he pulls me close again.
The Metlacs will be back. We need to find shelter and build a fire.
Shelter's not a problem. I know the perfect place. I point at the wrecked ship with its flashing light. For a moment, it looks as if he wants to argue, but then he nods.
I will follow your lead.
Now there's a change.
Hayden. She's safe. Overwhelming relief moves through me in waves, as if spurred by my Kui. It has been humming its song loudly ever since she appeared on the horizon, waving a flaming blanket. To think that she risked her safety to protect me from Metlaks? It is humbling. While Metlaks are normally not a danger to hunters, these were younger and therefore more aggressive. Their attack caught me by surprise, as did Josie's rescue. She came to rescue me. I rubbed my chest, absurdly pleased by the thought. My mate heads toward the flashing, strange light on the horizon, chattering. It's a ship, she tells me, even as she cradles her injured hands in front of her, palms up. It's a ship and she has found others inside, and that is why she was returning down the trail, because she realized she couldn't stay and do nothing, and it's frustrating, but she has to do the right thing, because that is what others would want her to do if the tables were turned. I listened to her with half an ear, lost in the song of my Kui. It is overwhelming me with her nearness, and I want to press her close to my body again. This is the first time I have been this close to her in days, and although I knew she was healthy, I cannot stop staring at her, at the sway of her hips as she walks, her graceful motions. She says something, and I grunt a response just in case she expects one. A moment later, she stops and turns to me, frowning.
"Will they be back?" she asks me.
The Metlaks? Yes, they will be curious and return once they have their courage. If we have a fire once more, they will leave for good. They are not smart creatures. She bites her lip and nods, squinting when the red light flashes bright into our eyes. Don't touch that thing, by the way. I learned the hard way. It's a little hot. She waves her damaged hands in the air.
You did not have to do that, I tell her. I wanted to help. They were attacking you. Were you in danger?
If I was at full strength, not likely. But I am weakened by the Kui's unfulfilled song and many days of travel. I nod. She smiles brightly, as if pleased by my feebleness.
Then I helped.
The urge to correct her rises in my throat, but she is so happy to be helpful that I bite the words back. I am still pleased by the idea that my mate sought to protect me. No one has ever fought for me before, and she hurt herself in the process. I am distressed by this, and humbled by it as well. I take her by the elbow and glance into the dark recess of the strange cave. Stay here and I will check for animals.
I've already been inside,
she says, wrinkling her strange, flat, movable human brow at me.
Weren't you listening?
Do I admit that I have ignored some of her chatter in favor of eyeing her body? I glance away and then back at her seeking eyes.
My concentration. The Kui.
It is difficult. I rub my chest to emphasize my lame answer. But she nods understanding.
I know what you mean.
Her cheeks flush a bright pink and she glances away as if shy. At any rate, it's safe in there. No live things, she shivers. Just dead ones. Very well. I want to chide her for wandering blindly into a cave that could have any sort of creature nesting in it, especially in Metlak territory. But we are not yelling at each other, and I am reluctant to make her angry. Not when the relief of seeing her is still pouring through me. I enter the mouth of the strange cave. It is much like the Elder's Cave, with its strange, smooth walls and floors. It makes me uneasy, but Josie needs shelter and a place to rest, so it will do. She clambers in after me, and I reach out to help her as she is favoring her hands. We move inside the large chamber several paces, and when we are far enough from the entrance, I gesture. Sit, I tell her. I will make a fire in this cave, and then we will take care of your hands.
I'm fine, she says quickly. I can help
Josie, I say, my voice gruff with irritation, and I watch her back stiffen. I choose my words carefully. You are clever and you are brave, but you are still injured. I am not. Let me do this and we will take care of your wounds. The sooner we treat them, the sooner they will feel better. And, greatly daring, I brush the backs of my fingers over her cheek. I should not, but I cannot help myself. I can no more resist touching her than I can resist breathing. I wait for her to shove my hands away. I wait for her to scowl up at me. But she only gazes up at me, her eyes big in her round human face, and then she nods, wincing.
They do hurt.
Then let me help. Let me take care of you, my mate. When she doesn't protest, I throw my pack down on the ground and pull a few things out of it. My strikers, for starting a fire. My bag of collected tinder and fluff, and a few dried dung cakes scooped up from the trail for future use. Then I close it again and gesture that she should sit on it. There are no comfortable sitting mats here, and my mate will not be forced to kneel on the cold ground. She sits down heavily, and I realize how tired she is. I stroke her soft hair, again unable to help myself, before I get up and begin to craft a fire pit nearby. There are no rocks to encircle it, but the floor itself is of a stone-like surface, so I clear it of deadfall and start my fire. My Josie needs warmth, a meal in her belly, hot tea, and a poultice for her burned hands. With no wind to hamper me, the fire starts easily, and soon I have it stoked to a brisk flame. I feed it all the tinder in my pouch, and then grab a handful of the debris I'd shoved aside to stoke it higher.
Can we move my seat closer? Josie asks, getting awkwardly to her feet.
I'd do it, but my hands are starting to sting pretty bad now.
Yes, I tell her, and move the seat close enough so she can enjoy the fire. I set up my tripod and then head to the entrance to fill the water sack with snow to boil. I sprinkle some herbs to make tea, and then glance at the entrance. Josie's things are spread out on the snow. It looks as if she scattered them in her haste to come help me, and I feel a surge of affection and lust for my mate. My clever, brave Josie.
Wait here and I will get your things, I tell her.
Not going anywhere, she says faintly, staring down at her hands.
They are paining her more than she wants to admit. I hate that. I grab her things, gathering her furs and her supplies in my arms. Her pouch of travel rations is impossibly light, almost empty, and I feel a pang of unease. What if she had run out? I picture my mate starving as she plods endlessly on the trail, and frustration wells inside my breast. Now is not the time to chastise her. I fill her satchel with armfuls of snow and return with the things to her side.
Here, I tell her, opening the mouth of her bag. This is full of snow. Put your hands in here. The cool of the snow will help the pain.
I must go and get more fuel for the fire and some leedy stalks for your hands.
Leedy?
It is a plant that grows like a vine amongst the rocks. It is good for burns. Helps them heal faster. She nods and sticks her hands into her bag, whimpering when the snow touches her skin.
Get me a whole bushel, then.
I will. Do not leave the fire. If the Metlax return, they will not come close. She looks up at me with worried eyes.
Will you be all right?
My queasy song grows even louder, and I rub my chest, fighting the lust I feel. She worries for me.
I will be fine. Have no fear.
Josie nods.
Hurry back.
Chapter 12. Hayden.
Every moment away from Josie's sides feels like salt water poured into a wound. Even though I know she is safe with the fire, I think of her with her hands pressed in the snow, of the pain she feels, of the Metlax returning and finding her unable to pick up a weapon. I must gather more fuel, though, or we will not be safe through the night. And more than anything, Josie needs the leedy stalks. I hurry, racing through the churned snow, following the trail of Divisti and scooping up their leavings. Once my bag is weighed down with dung, I race to the nearest cliff and pry apart the cracks in the stone with my knife, looking for the twisty, skinny roots that grow between the cracks. When I find enough to satisfy me, I head back toward the cave. A hopper jumps out of the bushes a short distance away, and I toss down my supplies to hunt a fresh meal for Josie. When I return to the cave, she's sitting by the fire, her hands in the bag, resting on the melting snow. The fire is crackling, and I watch her nudge the coals with the tip of her boot every so often. Her eyes brighten at the sight of me, laden with a fresh kill and bulging pouches.
I'm glad you're back.
My face cracks into a smile. She is glad to see me. Josie looks startled at my smile, and hers widens.
I hope you brought plenty of that lily root, because my hands are killing me.
Killing you? I rush to her side, dropping my burdens. You are dying? Let me see them.
Wait, wait, it's a figure of speech,
she says, and the words mean nothing to me. But she pulls her hands out of her bag and shows me the blistered skin.
It just means they hurt really bad.
Then we will fix it now. I grab some soap berries out of my scattered supplies and go to the snowy ledge at the edge of the cave and wash my hands and the leedy roots clean. Then I return to her side and shove them into my mouth, grimacing at their terrible taste. Her eyes widen.
I thought the roots were for me.
I chew, my teeth grinding the tough roots.
They are, I grit out. The poultice must be chewed before it is spread.
Oh, her eyes widened.
You going to spit that crap out on my hands?
I nod. I am going to spit this crap on your hands, yes.
That sounds awful, but they hurt bad enough that I'm willing to go for it, she admits, wrinkling her nose and watching me chew.
The roots are very fibrous and have a sharp, bitter taste to them. They also leave the lips and tongue numb, and by the time I spit the first mouthful out onto her palm, my stomach is turning at the flavor. She squeals in horror at the mushy greenish lump I left on her hand, but when I begin to gently spread it over her burns, her noises of dismay turn into a little sigh of pleasure.
Oh, wow, it feels better. and because it pleases her, I gamely fill my mouth with more of the awful-tasting root so I can ease her pain. By the time her hands are covered, my lips and tongue are numb, the taste of Leedy feels as if it is etched into my teeth, but she isn't making the tiny sounds of distress anymore, so it was worth every foul mouthful.